This is an ABC podcast.
If you're at work feeling stressed right now, you are not alone. And there are a lot of attempts to fix that. Mindfulness and wellness courses have become big business. And many organisations and companies offer lunchtime meditation or yoga sessions for staff, or an intranet site with wellness resources. That coaching is supposed to help us all cope. But how do we know any given program works? And can any workplace wellness program fix stresses that might be caused by bigger issues than a lack of yoga in your lunchtime? From the lands of the Kulin Nation, this is Life Matters. If you've done a mindfulness, meditation or other mental wellness course at work, what was that experience like? Did it make a difference? You can head to our Facebook page too and pop a comment there and tell us how it went for you and whether you felt it made a difference. Mindfulness or wellness sessions are increasingly being offered in the workplace. Let's look at how useful they are and the evidence base that they might be drawing on. Nicholas Van Dam is the director of the Contemplative Studies Centre and an associate professor at Melbourne University. Nicholas, welcome back to Life Matters.
Thanks.
And Rachel Clements is an organisational psychologist and director of psychological services at a company called the Centre for Corporate Health. Rachel, welcome to you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you here. Nicholas Van Dam, let's define mindfulness if we can and how it might intersect with our definition of meditation as well.
Sure. So mindfulness is used as a term in a lot of different ways. The most common definition is one that was provided by Jon Kabat-Zinn, who is kind of considered to have popularized the idea in the West starting in the late 1980s. So Jon Kabat-Zinn says it's the awareness that arises through paying attention. And so it's this idea that you're becoming more aware of what's going on, what you're experiencing, by very specifically attending to something. And the way in which you're doing that, you're attending things, is on purpose. So it's something that you do intentionally. It's not something that happens to you. It's not something that's an accident. You have to kind of go out of your way to cultivate it. It's in the present moment. So it's this idea that we're trying to be where we are. And it's non-judgmentally. And the idea about that non-judgment component is that we're trying to just be open to experience. So whether it's good, bad, somewhere in between, boring, neutral, we're just open to it, whatever it is. So that's the definition that Jon Kabat-Zinn gives. But there's a bit of fuzziness and there's a bit of debate about that. Now, that gets talked about, that this idea of mindfulness gets talked about in the context of mindfulness activities or exercises. It gets talked about in meditation. It gets talked about in a number of other contexts. And so there's a lot of fuzziness as to what we mean. And there is a particular form of meditation that is mindfulness meditation. And so meditation, it represents a whole other host or set of activities. So mindfulness meditation is a formal practice whereby one is actually trying to cultivate or create mindfulness.
And the meditation aspects can be drawn from various different longer-term spiritual traditions too, can't they? They might have other aims, like spiritual aims.
Absolutely. And look, that's where mindfulness and the way that Jon Kabat-Zinn talks about it, where it's coming from originally is Buddhism. And the goal there is actually something like enlightenment. And meditation as a term actually comes from Christianity. And so the goal there often is sort of, you know, communion with God. So many forms of meditation often have as a goal some connection with something much bigger, something spiritual. And some forms of meditation also just have as a goal a sense of, you know, greater focus, greater attention. So there's a wide variety of goals that are associated with meditation practices.
Rachel Clements, when we think about the courses that your organization runs, do they draw on those definitions specifically?
Yes, certainly. When the programs that we run are generally provided to our corporate workplaces, where workplaces may realise that we might have a leadership population or an employee population that may be struggling with aspects of their well-being. So what we tend to do in our program is definitely work on some of those aspects that Nicola was talking around, certainly increasing people's self-awareness of where they are in their own well-being or their own mental health, whether it might be increased focus or attention if their prefrontal cortex is feeling very tired and depleted. But in our programs, we also infuse a whole lot of really holistic resilience or well-being strategies, very influenced by some of the work of cognitive behavior therapy or neuroscience or acceptance and commitment therapy, adult learning principles. So we're embedding a really holistic framework to give people an evidence base. We are very, very strong in whatever we are providing our clients. definitely comes from a strong evidence base, but also infusing it to make it really practical. How do I use this tool in the workplace? If I'm feeling overwhelmed, what can I do in this moment that might calm me down and reduce my anxiety a little? So we're trying to combine the evidence base with the practicality to increase people's coping resources and coping skills.
So it can be tailored for particular workplaces and draw on different kind of strands and ideas about what constitutes mental resilience or mental wellness, yeah?
Absolutely. I think that is really the key. It's not a one-size-fits-all. Every program that we design for our clients is really based on their unique psychosocial risk factors that are emerging. And probably the biggest ones that most of our clients are speaking to us around now, for example, for leaders, it's very much around how they are traveling at the moment. There's very high levels of burnout among our leadership population. Everyone seems to be really struggling with the concept of managing hybrid teams. So we're doing very tailored programs around those two psychosocial risks for leaders. And for staff at the moment in our workplace population, it's definitely dealing with the concept of ambient stress. This constant level of stress that we've got just bubbling below the surface that we've become so used to and accustomed to in the last couple of years. I would say anxiety is probably the number one emotion of 2022. Mm. And also the staff now dealing with, well, how am I now getting into new routines when I'm now asked to come back into work and adjusting to that change? It again.
So Rachel, could you give us an example of what might happen in one of the sessions that you run, particularly focused on staff rather than leadership?
Yes, for example, if it's a staff session, obviously for us, we're always really inspired by getting behaviour change for people. So the longer the program, the better. In our corporate space, we're heavily influenced by people's time. Some programs we may do, it might just be we have a lunch and learn session that we'd love to give our team to help them with their struggles that we know that they have at the moment. For others, it might be we really want to invest quite heavily. We may even be able to have, you know, 2x2-hour sessions, which we like to do over a period of time. I think if we're really talking around real behaviour change, it's around trying to do small amounts of information over a longer time period. But concepts that we might introduce in our current programs for anxiety or dealing with that ambient stress and burnout are certainly things such as really looking at giving them self-awareness of where they are on their own well-being. So that includes a little bit of that mindfulness-based awareness and focus. We are very heavily influenced by that cognitive flexibility and cognitive adaptability, giving people those skills to be able to reframe situations that may come towards them. It might be increasing their level of optimism or emotional regulation strategies, helping people to teach them techniques to boost their self-efficacy or their locus of control, being really mindful of how they're using their energy at the moment. Are they dipping that into a whole lot of negative emotion, or are they able to be more aware and more conscious around their levels of emotion and maybe use a whole lot of positive emotion techniques as well? It could be increasing their social support as well, or even their stress tolerance to negative emotions.
We're speaking today with Rachel Clements, who's an organisational psychologist and director of psychological services at a company called the Centre for Corporate Health. They run courses within companies and organisations that are focused on things like mindfulness and resilience and helping people cope better at work. Nicholas Van Dam is with us too. He's the director of the Contemplative Studies Centre and an associate professor at Melbourne University. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, whether you've done one of these courses at work that's designed to help you with your well-being generally, and what effect that you feel it had. Our ABC Radio National Facebook page is the place to leave your comment. Nicholas, if we look at the proven benefits of the practices that you talked about before, mindfulness and meditation, how do we know that they are effective when using those definitions for starters?
So I guess, well, proven's a strong word. I would say sort of we don't really prove anything in science. We sort of get evidence and we sort of support things, and science changes. And over time, sort of, you know, we may find that things that we used to think worked don't work anymore. And that's sort of often a source of frustration among the general population, is that, you know, we kind of change our minds. And that's just because that's the way that science works. But look, when we talk about mindfulness, as I described it, We know that it works reasonably well for a variety of people. As Rachel mentioned, it, you know, it's not a one-size-fits-all thing, even with these programs. The ones that we know the most about are these structured programs. So they're often 8-week programs. They can be longer. They require sort of something like 2 to 3 weeks, 2 to 3 hours per week of getting together with a group, as well as 45 minutes of home practice almost daily. And so when we look at those practices, we know that they can have benefits across a variety of domains, including anxiety, depression, stress, and any number of things. When we start to talk about changing or modifying those programs, when we start to water them down, when we start to offer them in different formats, either online or via apps, the effect sizes get smaller, so they don't work as well.
So the kind of time lengths that Rachel Clements has mentioned before, 1 hour or a 2x2 hour, how much effect might you see out of those?
Probably very little. When there's sort of discussions that, you know, 5 minutes is all you need. And what sort of seems to be coming out, some preliminary research that we have seems to suggest that the greatest benefits seem to come from just doing this over and over repeatedly. So Rachel did mention behavior change, and certainly that is the goal. In order to really see a change in behavior, to see a change in context, you have to repeatedly do something over and over and over again. So when we look at sort of studies that do very short programs or short interventions, people may feel better in the moment. They may feel less stressed, they may feel less anxious in that moment, but that's unlikely to do a whole lot in terms of the next time they get stressed out or get anxious again. So, and that's really the big problem, you know, and the big question, I guess, is with these kinds of programs, unless we're actually teaching people how to resolve the bigger problems that they face. And I guess when we're talking about companies and corporate well-being, and we're talking about the context in which people are working, if we're not addressing the broader issues that people face, they may feel a little bit more relaxed or a little bit less stressed or a little bit less anxious in the moment. But unless the broader context changes, and unless they feel like they actually are developing the skills to deal with the problems as they arise the next time, and the time after that, and the time after that, we're probably not going to see a whole lot of benefit. And the data sort of seems to support that.
We've got a lot of text coming in on this. Judith in Brisbane says, in my experience, mindfulness activities put the blame on employees, not stress, workload, or conflict. A very effective ploy by management, says Judith. Mindfulness, says someone else, the new opiate of the masses. It makes me want to scream. Burnt out? Can't cope with the situation? Don't get rid of the negative emotions. And then in caps, use the negative emotions to drive for change. Otherwise, we all sit there in our meditative calm, blaming our individual mindsets and do nothing about things that should be different. Some strong views coming in. Rachel Clements, how do you know that the programs you're offering are effective? Are they evidence-based?
Yes, I mean, the best way is to measure it. So on the longer programs that we're able to do, so if we have a client organisation that would that does invest in longer programs, where we might be doing a series of, you know, here's three 90-minute sessions over a 6-week period, or here's 2x2 hours over a 6-week period, we actually do pre, sometimes during and post measures. So what we do is we can measure that change and that behaviour change to be able to show the efficacy of that behaviour change over time. What we also try to do, because it is all, as Nicholas was saying, it's really in the embedding. To look at true behaviour change, you're really looking at the constant embedding of this information over time. So that's where things like apps can be quite useful. It can be also, we also have an employee assistance program as well. So sometimes someone might be doing a corporate program with us, and sure, it might only be an hour long, and that might not necessarily give big behaviour change, but it may give one strategy, and it also might be an entry point into that further coaching or that further one-on-one assistance. So it does sometimes form a pathway into the one-on-one assistance where we're able to get, we're working much more tailored towards an individual's circumstances, and then taking good measures of the pre and the post so as that we can see what that behaviour change has been like.
So that's the kind of assessment afterwards. But when I say evidence-based, are they based on peer-reviewed scientific research? Are we certain that the methodologies that you're using are based on research?
Well, the methodologies that we are using are definitely based on evidence-based psychological concepts, such as cognitive behaviour therapy or a lot of the strategies coming out of the neuroscience research or acceptance and commitment therapy. So, yes, the evidence is definitely there for the strategies that we are providing people in our programs. And actually, upon reflection, when we are able to do longer programs and do track that behaviour change, overall we have found very, very strong efficacy for positive behaviour change from pre-measures into post-measures. And we also run this type of a program one-on-one over 12 sessions with people. And again, the program is very tailored. Sometimes we're doing it with people who have a mental health issue and they're not feeling so great, and we use it as a strategy to get them well again. And we've taken very strong, robust measures on the one-on-one assistance, and that's been able to really show very strongly people have increased capacity for work, their depression, anxiety and stress scores have improved considerably, and it results in significant behaviour change on those one-on-one individual coaching programs.
So, Rachel, who delivers the programs? Are they all delivered by psychologists, or are there any other qualifications people need to have?
Well, for our programs, yes. So we're very strict that they must all be registered psychologists to be able to deliver these programs. We always say it's not just an information session. We're really trying to instill, even if it's one thing, and even if we're just doing a 1 hour lunch and learn, my biggest takeaway I try to give participants and our team is very much just one thing that you might take away today to shift from the knowing into the doing. And even just knowing one little thing that was better off before you came in might actually be able to make that wonderful difference. And if you practice that one thing over and over, then that might result in that little bit of behaviour change and could make a wonderful difference to your wellbeing.
Nicholas Van Dam, is it enough to have a psychologist offering a course like this? Because there can occasionally be harms emerging from various kinds of meditation and mindfulness, can't there? Do you need someone with particular qualifications?
Yeah, look, it depends on what you're doing, right? I think there's this common idea that sort of mindfulness comes within, or, you know, we're not necessarily talking about mindfulness, we're talking about wellness as a whole, but mindfulness is this idea that it is owned or is within the purview of psychology. And it's not, as we talked about earlier on, you know, the original idea comes from Buddhism and is inspired often by other traditions. And that's not to say that Buddhists own it, but they certainly know a lot about it. And so I think if we're talking about people teaching or training people in mindfulness or any form of meditation, you certainly would hope that people have rigorous personal experience sort of trying out and learning the techniques and knowing how to deliver them effectively. And one of the things that we often see is that that's not true. People sort of delivering meditation teaching don't always, or meditation training don't necessarily have the kind of same level of rigorous qualification, say, as what a psychologist is expected to have when dealing with mental health issues. So I think it's really great in Rachel's instance that they're saying, well, they've got psychologists present, and those psychologists probably can help when issues arise. I guess there's a whole other issue that comes up, though, in terms of if you're guiding people through activities or exercises that are meditation based, you may struggle to help people resolve those, because some of those things may be issues that are sort of based on ideas about concepts really that are really big, like, you know, is the self really what you think it is? And, you know, you can give people sort of practical psychological advice about that, and you can try to help guide them through that. But I guess the real question is a psychologist the person that's going to help someone to kind of resolve the issues around what is the purpose of their life, and who are they as an individual, and do they exist the way that they think they ought to? And for some, that those kinds of probing questions can result in some serious distress and some serious sort of existential questioning as to who and what they are. So I think what we probably need sort of is somebody who has kind of training in both, you know, someone who has training in guiding meditation and practice in meditation, particularly if that's what's being used, as well as awareness of psychological issues so that they can manage those kinds of potential harms or risks, which include things like panic attacks, becoming more depressed, becoming suicidal, and even things as severe as psychotic breaks in around 5 to 8% of people when they're engaging in meditation practices.
Mm. So more texts on this. Contrary to the views of a previous texter, mindfulness is useful for the things we can't change. When we've changed the things we can and had the wisdom to know the difference, that's definitely drawing on the Christian tradition there. Another says, I worked in a stressful workplace with high need, sometimes suicidal clients. 1 hour of mindfulness over 8 weeks did give me strategies to cope better. And Laurie says, sorry, but the whole mindfulness bandwagon is just about blaming employees for under-resourcing and understaffing in the constant pursuit of more profit. That is a big question, Rachel Clements. Some employees might view making time to do these courses as just a box-ticking exercise that actually adds to their workload and is really, as you said, designed to kind of increase their self-efficacy and their resilience and their ability to be more productive at work. Is that a useful thing when you're actually looking at people's holistic wellness?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I think any well-being program or resilience program that you may be trying to introduce, it's really important that you are looking also, that the organization is also looking at those inherent psychosocial risks that may be causing the problem in the first place. So if it is, you know, incredible organizational change or high workloads, a resilience program or a mindfulness program or a well-being program is not going to fix that. It might may enable people to cope with that, but also you do sometimes run the risk that people feel as if, well, I'm just being told to get more resilient through this change and I've just got to get better at this. So I really think it's the messaging and the leadership messaging of these programs makes, you know, can make them wonderful success stories, or equally make them, you know, perhaps have a bit more of a negative flavor where it may feel like more of a ticker box. But I think if that leadership support is there and you're definitely serious about addressing some of those other unique psychosocial risk factors that are causing some of those stressors in the first place, then that's quite, you know, that's quite a different perspective. So I think it's all in the messaging, it's all in the setup and the leadership support and sponsorship behind these programs as well.
And not just the psychosocial focus, but the actual material focus of, as you say, workloads and resourcing. How often do you see that in your clients, that they step back and go, oh, wow, we've really seen that there's a problem with resourcing and we're going to fill that gap rather than just giving some more yoga sessions?
Yeah, I think now we are starting to work with our clients who are a lot more sophisticated about getting on top of psychosocial risks. And, you know, that can certainly be perhaps from a procedural framework or maybe a legal framework. But I really think that people are a lot more educated, organizations are a lot more educated now about the need to create mentally healthy teams, to be aware of psychosocial risks within teams as they're emerging, and to be able to be very good at putting effective measures and controls in place to protect and mitigate against potential harm that they may cause.
Really interesting conversation. Obviously, it sparked a lot of response from our listeners. Thank you both for your time today, Rachel Clements and Professor Nicholas Van Dam.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Rachel Clements is co-founder and director of psychological services at a company called the Center for Corporate Health. She's an organizational psychologist. And Associate Professor Nicholas Van Dam is director of contemplative studies, the Contemplative Studies Center at Melbourne University. Lots of text. I'll just leave you with this one. These workplace mindfulness programs might be beneficial for some, but like other workplace adjustments, it should be tailored to the individual. If my work offered freedom to choose, I'd ditch the corporate stuff, just go get a massage. This is Life Matters. Something that's proven to lower our stress levels is nature. And you're going to meet three women next who've used walking to deal with difficult emotions. This is RN.
Hello, James Carlton from God Forbid here. Has a new spirituality around childbirth emerged in Australia? And are Catholic funerals a dying rite? And with marriage on the decline, what do Australian relationships look like in 2022? From the latest census, a three-part series, Births, Deaths and Marriages, looking at the changing spiritual and religious attitudes across the lifespan. Join me on God Forbid Sundays at 6 a.m. on ABCRN or at any time on the ABC Listen app.
Everyone has their own way of processing grief, and sometimes place can play a huge part in dealing with loss. For three Tasmanian women, walking became a source of healing as they came to terms with deep griefs. For Mary Dwyer, it was a walking pilgrimage. For Becca Lunnan, mountain climbing. And for Gabrielle Gartrell, treks on beaches in wilderness and through desert. They helped her walk through her pain and find joy again. Producer Helene Thomas brings you this story.
You know, I was intentionally walking because I was grieving in grief, and I knew that I needed to keep on moving my body.
It was a year and a half after her husband's death that Mary Dwyer walked the Camino de Santiago in northwestern Spain. She was 50 at the time, and she walked 850 kilometres over a six-week period. The walk played a pivotal role in her grieving process. She tells me about that time as we walked together along a coastal track not far from her home in southern Tasmania.
I mean, not only is the walking help you clear your mind, but you strengthen your body physically. But especially that walk, it was filled with so many moments where the path informed the healing. So it's not me healing, the path informed the healing, and a great sense, an embedded sense of you are okay, you will be okay, everything's okay.
Becca Lunnan took off to the mountains in Tasmania just a few months after her partner died. It's something they did together. It's where they fell in love.
And it was brilliant. It was sometime in winter because he died in April. So the days were short. It was one of those like really clear nights, but cold. And as soon as the sun went down, everything just glistened with frozen dew, I guess it was. And it's just one of those magical moments. And when you're out there and you are emotional, you can laugh, you can cry, you can do whatever you want, you can scream at the top of your lungs. It's great. And there's little things like that, the beauty in nature that makes you realise that things will be okay and the world does go on.
3 months after her partner's death, Gabrielle Gartrell spent 8 days walking the South Coast Track in southern Tasmania.
I remember it was really, the weather was beautiful and I swam every day. I didn't have a watch, I didn't have a camera or a phone. And you'd wake up in the morning to birds and to daylight and drink tea from a river. You know, I'd sit down and watch butterflies, or I'd sit and just contemplate moss or flowers. And it was just, everything seemed to be beautiful. So I think nature put me into a state of seeing beauty when I was feeling so much loss and feeling so much sadness and grief. So nature gave me that gift of beauty.
A common thread has woven its way through these three women's lives. A commitment to step one foot in front of the other as they have grieved the death of their partners. While walking has played a big role throughout their lives, Mary, Becca and Gabrielle came into relationship with it at different stages and in different ways. Becca's adventurous streak emerged when she was 25. Up until then, her life was quite tame.
That was pretty boring. That was very boring.
It was while working in an outdoor store in Hobart that Becca decided to go on her first bushwalk. It was more of a case of should go than want to. She admits not knowing anything about bushwalking equipment, and she thought she'd better learn
a little bit about the gear that I was selling, because you asked me what a gator is and I was like, I've never heard of such a thing, let alone why you should choose one over another one. It was quite a steep learning curve, and so I was like, right, I'll be committed to this job and I will go out and I'll start doing some bushwalks.
It was this walk that led to a quest to climb all the mountains in Tasmania. In 10 years, she's climbed over 400. She's got around 50 or so to go. She remembers his first bushwalk vividly.
We had this brilliant, perfect weekend where we went down to the Huon River campground at Scott's Peak. We drove down one night, stayed there that night, and then the next morning we got up and we put some kayaks on Lake Petter, one of those crystal clear mirror reflection kind of days, and we paddled out to Scott's Peak. I landed on this lovely little sandy isthmus that's there, parked the boats and walked up to the top of Scott's Peak, and we sat there surrounded by water and mountains, 360 degree views of mountains that were reflected in the water because it's still calm as anything. And I was like, don't have any of the gear, don't know what any of those mountains are, but one day I will, and one day I'm going to visit as many of those mountains as I can. I was thoroughly addicted from that walk.
Gabrielle recalls a strong desire to walk right from when she was a child, as though she was put on this earth to move through various landscapes on foot.
Walking or being on the land was just kind of in my feet, was in my bones from that early age. Yeah, it was definitely just a way of being. I was more comfortable outside in nature than I was anywhere else. So that's where I gravitated.
Mm. So your walks have been, you know, the point of a walk, has it been to get into nature?
Mainly, yep. And then kind of later in life, it's been either to exercise or to calm a farm. You know, I'm a little bit, sometimes I kind of say I have to work myself like a dog, you know, like a dog you have to run them just to kind of calm them down and settle them. And I think walking and that repetitive motion, left, right, you know, there's a lot of research around that as well about the effect that walking has on recalibrating your nervous system or your neurology.
Mary was introduced to bushwalking through her husband, Adrian. And while they both loved the Tasmanian wilderness and explored it endlessly together, there may have been an ulterior motive. After all, they were only in their early 20s when they first walked together.
I think it was a check each other out activity, actually. Yeah, it worked.
But it wasn't until Adrian died that Mary found herself wanting to do really long walks, like the Camino, because of what she gained physically, emotionally and mentally.
I learnt the benefit of long walks, day after day after day after day, because there's something, I think, profoundly different happens to you when you're on the road for a long period of time.
She describes it as being sandpapered.
You know, the polishing that Michelangelo did on the Pietà, the sanding of her beautiful, beautiful face, the last bit was really with fine sandpaper, rubbing off all the tiny bits. So walking feels like I am being sandpapered and crafted into something that is much more beautiful.
For Becca, it's walking on open ridgelines where she finds herself completely open and free.
It's just the feeling. It's freedom. It's on the edge. Great big smile, open heart. Nothing can change or take that moment away. It's all just perfect. It's like it's the most in the moment you can be. And even better if there's someone to share it with.
Becca's partner, Graham, was the person she shared her walks with mostly. In between her shifts as a paramedic and him running his own business, they'd have their sights set on the next mountain to climb. Either that, or they'd work away in their garden or play tennis. On the morning of Good Friday 2020, Graham had a sudden cardiac arrest. Becca resuscitated him, and they managed to get his heart started again. But he died later in hospital.
It just tears your world apart. You have this idea about what your world is to you, and everybody has like some central pillars in it, I suppose. And I had one big one, and it was him. Everything that I did was around our relationship. And he was right at the center of it. The two of us were at the center of it. So the decisions I made around work were about how that would work for what we wanted to do together, whether or tennis or walking, whatever else. It was all, yeah, around us. And then that was gone. Yeah. I just, like, God. It was gone. And then you have all the grief around that. And eventually you have to pull yourself together and decide how you want to, I don't know what the right words are. It's not a move on, but how you want to take the next few steps. And what you want your life to look like now that your number one choice is no longer possible. It's not an easy place to get to. There's a lot of questioning about whys and what. And if onlys. And it takes a bit to get over that bit too. Yeah.
When Gabriel's partner Richard died, following his near 6-year journey with cancer, as a new single mother of two girls, 11 and 15 at the time, she only knew one thing, to walk as she'd always done.
In that time post-death, when excessive love and pain are the extremes, but also, you know, the most clear points of feeling, I knew I needed space and time, and I knew to process the intensity of my reality, I needed space and time, so I went bush. I remember walking in, and I walked about 100 metres down the track, and I stopped and I looked up at the sky, and the clouds just formed a very detailed image of Richard's face, and I just sobbed and sobbed on the track, and it was him saying to me, you know, you're on the right track, you're doing the right thing, take time.
It was something Richard had always known about Gabrielle and had encouraged her to do whenever he could see she was struggling.
I'm going to laugh now because I've just got this little voice of Richard's going, man, I told you to get out and go for a walk. Often Richard would say to me if I was feeling overwhelmed by the reality or the hugeness or what I thought was the hugeness of our experience, he'd go, just go for a walk. You've got to go for a walk, you know, and the kids would always go, Mum, go for a walk. So if I was, you know, getting frustrated or agitated or they could see that I wasn't relaxed or restful, they'd kick me out and say, go for a walk. So, yeah, walking's been a way to kind of regulate myself, I guess, a way to calm down and find my humour and my playfulness again.
For these women, walking has stretched out time, and it is time and space that they've needed for healing. Mary walking the Camino gave rise to her heart opening up again.
Most of all, I got the willingness to love again. So that, and in order to do that, and that's Kookaburra's lovely, in order to do that, I had to drop a lot of the pain that I was carrying and fear. I can remember arriving in the plaza in the middle of, just outside the cathedral in Santiago. And there, you know, often pilgrims walk in around about lunchtime. And I can remember sitting, like getting there, and sitting on the cathedral steps and crying with celebration and relief and exhaustion and humbleness. And this most gorgeous, gorgeous young Australian woman who I'd met on the track said that she'd been having a cup of coffee and thought, oh, maybe there might be one or two pilgrims who walk in today. And she came and she saw me sitting there and she came up behind me and just gave me the biggest cuddle. And someone else took a photo of that moment. And I think that, you know, the photo in some ways sort of shows a completely open person. If Adrian's death cracked me open, then the Camino filled me with light. Yeah.
For Becca, the last 2 years has been about coming to terms with walking alone without Graham, but all the while feeling him by her side.
Yeah, that was part of it. It was like, oh, we're not going to go for a walk together in the way that we used to. And yet, being out there, I'd still see things or remember things or there was a part of him that was always going to be with me and that was always going to be out there to find, which, yeah, it's like that bittersweet thing. It's, there's bits that are hard, but there's also the bits that make it just fine. And good.
Becca Lunnan, ending that story by Helene Thomas. And you can find more details about all of the guests in this story by heading to the Life Matters homepage. If you're after a less hardcore approach to exercise that still ticks the health and fitness boxes, that's next on Life Matters. When you think of fitness, what springs to mind? A short, sharp run? A high-intensity workout? Kickboxing? Well, did you know you can still reap the benefits if you're not pushing yourself that hard? For example, there's something called NEAT, non-exercise activity thermogenesis. And its proponents say that incidental activity, walking, gardening, fidgeting, can have a huge impact on your health and well-being. This is very exciting news for me, I have to say. Have you incorporated some extra incidental activity into your life? What changes did you notice? Tony Blazevich is Professor of Biomechanics and Director of the Centre for Exercise and Sports Science Research at Edith Cowan University. Tony, welcome to Life Matters.
Morning, Hilary. I hope everything's going well.
Yes, yeah, fidgeting away here, really burning the calories. Before we delve too far into how it works, can you describe exactly what NEAT means, N-E-A-T?
Yeah, N-E-A-T, non-exercise activity thermogenesis, which is just a sexy way of saying we're burning energy, which of course liberates heat in that sort of metabolic process. It includes everything, all the activity that's not deliberate exercise. You just mentioned fidgeting. You've of course just been talking about going for a walk. It could be gardening, could even be dancing in the living room. All of that comes under this sort of need, this energy that we burn. And I guess the other term that you may have heard is NEPA, non-exercise physical activity. So that non-exercise physical activity causes the energy sort of burning, the NEAT, if you will.
Is it a blurry line? I mean, dancing in the living room sounds a little bit like exercise.
Yeah, it sounds like exercise, but it's physical activity. But I guess it's the sort of the researchers in this area have decided that if you do it spontaneously, it's not in a deliberate setting, then we call it NEAT or NEPA rather than deliberate exercise. So if you go to a dance class every week and do deliberate dance training, we would call that physical exercise. If you go to the gym and do a rumba class, you know, that's physical exercise. But if you just happen to hear a great song and decide for the next 4 minutes you're going to dance in the living room, that's just additional incidental exercise.
Someone sent a text saying, just put your tea and coffee upstairs. Sorted.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Yeah. How did we used to get this kind of activity back in the day, and what's changed?
Well, I guess two things have changed. So you probably hear, you know, back in the Paleolithic era, you know, we had to walk and, you know, to get food, and we had to dig to get roots, and we had to do a lot of physical activity. Actually, humans, of course, are innately lazy. We prefer not to do physical activity. We just had to. And then I guess in the 1800s, you had the Industrial Revolution. So now lifting and pushing and pulling and digging could be mechanized. But really now we have that computerization, that digital lifestyle. So now more than 70% of us sit for our living. We can drive the car to the shop. We can get it delivered online if we want to. And even our entertainment. I mean, our entertainment is what? TVs, tablets, phones, computer games. We're humans are remarkable creatures for making life easier for ourselves, which has a lot of positive outcomes. But of course, in this regard of physical activity, it's also causing us some problems.
I did see one personal trainer online saying, you know, we've got all these labour-saving devices, even your toothbrush. You don't have to move it around anymore. I'm like, back off, yeah, Sonny Jim. Don't take my toothbrush away from me.
That's exactly right. There's a line.
It's about how we choose to use our time, isn't it? Rather than, you know, saying we should go back to washing our clothes by hand.
Yeah, exactly right. I think the key is that awareness, that awareness of every once in a while, even in our very busy lifestyles, of just taking a bit of a helicopter view of what we do in our daily life. And I guess the key to that is really recognizing all the benefits, which I'm sure we'll talk about, and just understanding that just moving has, you know, huge benefits for both physical and mental health, even if, and this is probably why I don't tend to use the NEAT term. Thermogenesis sounds awesome, and we always talk about body fat and BMIs and everything else, but the benefit of movement far outstrips any benefit you'll get from just burning energy per se or losing the body fat per se. And once you sort of understand a bit more about that, you'll probably be desperate to move a bit more.
Yeah, that really broke my mind, that high-intensity exercise, the formal exercise that we think of when we talk about exercise, I mean, it has benefits, but it's got a really small impact on your total daily energy expenditure. So it's maybe not that great if you're trying to lose weight.
Yeah, and no one wants to hear that. I mean, don't get me wrong. If you've got these athletes out there training for, you know, 2 hours a day at high intensity, something like 50% of all their energy output is in that deliberate exercise. But for most of us who are kind of moving through the day, and then do our, you know, half hour of exercise as we're taught to by the guidelines. It really is quite a small amount of physical activity. And of course, once you move, there are processes going on in your body that help to make us eat a bit more as well. So the overall benefit from just a weight loss point of view is relatively minor. But of course, the mental and physical health benefits are quite phenomenal.
Well, let's talk a bit more about those. What kind of benefits do we see when we just up that incidental activity, the non-exercise physical activity in our day without really worrying too much about the formal high-intensity stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. So let's pretend you're not going to, you know, move your entire occupation from being an office worker to a farmer. And we're really talking about you and your current environment. You've probably got kids or stresses at home and you're just trying to make those minutes and minutes here and there. I guess there are several effects that are really important, and we can pick a few apart if you want to go into more detail. And the first one is that increase in energy output. I mean, of course, over a small amount of time, you're not going to get abs by adding a bit of gardening or walking to your daily routine, fidgeting a bit more. But you know, if you start to talk about 10 and 20 years down the track, the current evidence is that it can make a noticeable difference to your body weight and to your body fat. So it will have an effect. It's just not going to do it by next week. But the big key is the increase in general movement. If we move through the day, so think about what it's like if you laid on the lounge for 8 hours, or if you sat and barely moved at all in your office for 8 hours, and then someone said, right, we're going down the shop, but it's 2 kilometres away, we're going to walk. You tend to sort of say, I really don't feel like walking. I mean, you notice how you feel more tired when you sit around and do nothing. Mm-hmm. A lot of physiological reasons for that. But if you just take small amounts of time, every hour you're doing a couple of minutes where you walk to the printer, walk to the toilet, walk to see a colleague, do the dishes if you're working at home, quickly get out into the garden and do a bit of weeding. That sort of daily or through the day movement means that when you then say in the afternoon, well, there's a 2K walk to the shop, actually you've been moving a bit all day and you tend to make that choice in a different way.
So Tony Blazevich, that means you can actually use it as an indicator of your overall health.
Well, yeah, exactly right. Yeah, well, you know that, right? If you've got kids at home and you haven't played much for a while and you start playing with the kids, you get tired. Or as you said, if you've left your coffee or tea upstairs and you walk up to get it and you realise that you're getting more tired at the top of the stairs, then that can be a nice indicator that you're probably not moving as much. And when you get that feedback, we tend to want to do something about it. You know, when you don't feel well, you start to think, well, maybe I need to do something.
And Tony Blazevich, I should mention, we're speaking with Tony Blazevich, who's a Professor of Biomechanics and Director of the Centre for Exercise and Sports Science Research at Edith Cowan University. And we're talking about NEPA, non-exercise physical activity, those incidental things that we kind of do during the day that get us moving that aren't, you know, putting the lycra on necessarily. Tony, you mentioned some mental health benefits. What are they?
Well, there's quite a few. I mean, let's just take going for a walk, and let's pretend it's going for a walk outside. So when you walk, your muscles are working, and your muscles are a reservoir of these signaling molecules, these anti-inflammatory proteins that can flood your body. They talk to your liver, they talk to your fatty tissues, they talk to your bones, they reduce inflammation. So think of it that every time you're moving, you're flooding your body with healthful stuff. So that's a really nice way to think of it. When you're moving, you're also increasing your blood flow, and that includes not only to your body and through your arteries to renew those arteries, it triggers self-renewal, but it also goes to your brain to increase brain blood flow, which is really good to get oxygen and everything to it. But we also notice that there are hormones released that directly affect the brain, the number of synapses in the brain, the way the brain is connected. It can affect our memory and our cognition. So going for a walk is great. And then as far as the real specific mental health benefits, the immediate benefits, you've got both an increase in those happy hormones, you know, the endorphins. When you start to move, particularly at low intensities, you tend to get a lot of the endorphins. You might notice if you haven't done gym for ages and you're trying to do a gym workout, it feels awful, and that's because there's a lot of stress hormones there. So that lower intensity stuff doesn't tend to give you that. But you also release things like serotonin, which you may have heard of, which makes us feel better. It binds to receptors in our brain and makes us feel better. And then if you are outside, even with your sunnies on, the sunlight hitting the iris of the eye seems to be really important. In countries where you don't see a lot of sunlight through the winter, you know, in Northern Europe, for example, where a lot of research has been done, Northern US, of course, that you have that sad, that seasonal affective disorder, and it's very clear that getting a little bit of sunshine is very, very helpful. So for your mental health, for releasing those molecules, for improving memory and cognition and everything else, just getting around and moving can have pretty dramatic effects.
We're getting some texts on this. One says, I find vacuuming is great movement. True. And Kim says, taking a break used to mean having a sit down, and now it means getting up and walking around, and that's why we're in trouble. Tony, what effect does it have if, you know, when we talk about exercise, everyone just assumes we're talking about formal exercise, where you do put the gear on and go and do a specific thing at a particular intensity? What effect does that have, particularly for people who don't feel comfortable in those settings, if we just aren't taking into account the amazing benefits of incidental activity?
Yeah, that is, to be fair, that is a problem. And that's a problem in the research, because if we want to see whether exercise is having an effect, we sort of want to give a decent dose, right? No one's going to give us, you know, a lot of funding to do a project that probably isn't going to show everything. So in order to understand the effects of exercise, the benefits of exercise, we sort of exercise someone a lot. So then when it gets to the media and they say, hey, these researchers just found these amazing effects, they say, well, what did they do? Ah, well, you know, they jogged for half an hour every day, or they, you know, did gym every day, or whatever they did. But the other problem is, of course, media. You know, media have to put on some sort of image on TV to show people moving and exercising. So they'll, you know, might have someone walking outside in the park, but they generally say, well, let's get someone on the bike in their Lycra, let's get someone in the gym lifting weights. And that's really nice visual. So I think we tend to get that idea. And not only, as I said, as you exercise more, those stress hormones that we can produce are really reduced. And so the overwhelming effects of the positive hormones win, right? So I'm not saying that always when you run or lift weights, it doesn't feel well. But for those of you who don't do it, when you first do it, it can feel a bit awful. And that can make you not want to do it, especially if you don't understand what's going on. You just feels awful. Like, I hate going to the gym, don't I? But also, if we can give options and show people that going out and sort of digging in the garden, not even with a shovel, I mean, just weeding or dancing in a lounge room, fidgeting more, walking a long way to the toilet, parking your car at the furthest part of the car park, and just taking that sort of time to yourself and being a little bit selfish and saying, oh, you know, I'm not going to get to work for another couple of minutes, and I don't care if I'm a few minutes late. You know, that sort of stuff is a great way to accumulate the physical activity, to have those mental and physical health benefits. And like I say, once you choose to do that, when humans choose to be a certain thing and to ingrain a certain lifestyle into themselves, they then make better choices elsewhere. You know, you tend to then think, oh, actually, I wouldn't mind that, you know, better food, or I'm not going to bother having that extra beer tonight. Or it doesn't mean you hate life, but you just tend to want to make better choices elsewhere. So there's offshoots.
It does not mean you hate life. That's so true. Yeah, it's like you're rewriting the script about yourself. I am the kind of person who gets exercise, even if it's just incidental exercise, and that is a good thing. Tony, thanks for helping us switch the script a bit here on Life Matters today.
No problem at all. Have a great rest of your day then.
Thank you. Great talking with you. Tony Blazevic, Professor of Biomechanics, Director of the Centre for Exercise and Sports Science Research at Edith Cowan University, has given me permission to fidget as much as I like. Nat Tencic, welcome to you.
Oh, so happy to hear I can fidget as well. I'm terrible.
It's good for you.
It's good, apparently. Not driving me insane. But lots of people are coming in with thoughts on the program today. Someone here on walking in nature for healing says, I went on a 12K walk in the forest on Sunday and felt so good. I'm still feeling happy. We'll definitely do it again and again. And lots was coming through in our conversation on mindfulness in the workplace.
I bet.
Plenty of people calling out some of the maybe double think about this. And Paul says, these types of resilience strategies and training seek to move the responsibility from the corporation organization to the individual. Why don't organizations deal with the cause issues? I suspect because it will impact on profit. Someone here went as far as to say it sounded like corporate gaslighting.
Wow.
Investing, cultivating less stressful work environment cultures instead, they say. Another person says resilience is another word for bend more and work harder and faster and put up with my manner. Mindfulness sessions at work and yoga do help in the moment, but it's Sisyphus with the massive rock without organisational and management behaviour change. And I wanted to get to this one from Lisa in Geelong, who says, what if my workplace is toxic and my manager is bullying me? Sometimes wellness is used by workplaces to numb the response to some awful events like this, like mass sackings or restructures or poor management.
And obviously we don't know about the individual workplaces this is happening in, but clearly people have strong views on the whole idea.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really like hit a chord with people. But also people are talking about the positives and benefits of meditation as well. Alex says, I've been practicing meditation and mindfulness since 1968 and I found it absolutely transformative. I'm now happier and than most after being more miserable than most.
54 years, that's impressive.
I know, I can barely do it for 2 minutes. Sonia says, after some years of meditation and mindfulness, I've found I've been able to sit back and watch behaviours, including my own, to become more realistic and better at handling stressful situations and meetings at work. Buddhist practice has been a wonderful thing for me. And a final thought here says, how wonderful to introduce people to mindfulness, meditation and self-awareness via the workplace. I suffered debilitating panic attacks in my youth, and meditation and the associated teachings were my saviour.
Thank you, Nat. You know how some animals are more charismatic than others? Like almost everyone loves koalas, but there are lots of unattractive creatures that sometimes need help too. And if an insect habitat is threatened, it can be much harder to mobilise people around it. So next time on Life Matters, we'll talk to someone who's passionate about creepy crawlies and learn why we should look a bit closer at insects, spiders, crustaceans, like the humble slater. You're going to learn some pretty startling facts about the slater on the next episode of Life Matters on RN.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.